BCFM.
Love Bestow. Love BCFM.
BCFM.
Their goal is to destroy all existing religions save theirs, all existing governments save theirs, and shackle the mob in a system of eternal oppressive debt chained to a computer for the rest of their life, in a propagandized world to make them believe that they are happy in this system.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Former US Secretary of State under Nixon, Henry Kissinger, makes Tony Blair and George W. Bush look like pussycats. Yes, he's the main man over at the Bilderberg Conference in Copenhagen. Kissinger never quite left office after organising coups from the White House in the 1970s, went into the private military consultation business. He's probably responsible for more deaths and destruction, more illegal overthrows of sovereign governments than anyone alive. Christopher Hitchens detailed Kissinger's war crimes in his book and BBC4 film, The Crimes of Henry Kissinger. From the secret bombing of Cambodia in the 1960s, the Vietnam War, destruction of Nicaragua, ordering the killing of Chile's elected left-wing President Allende, and installing fascist General Pinochet and an Indonesian dictatorship. Also, the Turkish invasion of Cyprus. Nothing, it seems, can stop King Henry. Kissinger's killing machine rolls on too as the evil eye beams into Syria, the Central African Republic and Ukraine, right up against the Russian borders, the spearhead of US corporate power in a war against the very idea of independent countries and anyone that comes to their aid. Well, this weekend, bankrolled by the world's number one oil and banking mogul, David Rockefeller, the Kissinger fan club, that is the Bilderberg Group, are having their four-day annual meeting in Copenhagen, Denmark. So, why aren't he and his war criminal friends arrested? Well, the politicians and the media barons that turn up are Kissinger's support that he's a nice guy after all. And Bilderberg is where it all comes together for Kissinger, his shadowy world of arms firms who profit from war, secret private armies, meets the world of our elected politicians, Cameron Osborne, Balls, Ken Clark, Peter Mandelson, all of who swear vows of secrecy as they arrive at the party. Big media corporations of the Western world are invited too, and those that attend, like the Financial Times and The Economist, also swear secrecy. One paper, though, The Guardian, though, is on the outside, and I'm joined now by Charlie Skelton, who's been writing for The Guardian. Hi, Charlie. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello.
Now, give us a brief idea of what this Bilderberg conference has been like for you. You've been to a few. Just paint the picture for us.
Well, it's been extremely expensive being in Copenhagen, but apart from that, it's been pretty good-natured in terms of the policing. We've had very good access to the conference venue, which is the Marriott Hotel in Copenhagen.
Not inside, though, no?
It's really, we've seen some big names and some big faces. People like, the head of NATO, Rasmussen, and the Allied Supreme Commander of Europe, Philip Breedlove, and people like that. So it's a very big and it seems quite sort of military-minded participant list this year.
Okay, what about the actual venue itself? Are you in the city centre, a big Marriott Hotel, and is there any sort of place for people who are observing, protesting, reporting on it like you?
Yeah, there is. I mean, there seems to be a fairly relaxed atmosphere around, with people allowed reasonably close to the hotel. I mean, I would say closer than anything in my experience. And, not that anyone is doing anything in particular in terms of protesting, apart from there's a large gathering of people, and there's also quite a lot of press and photographers around, sort of milling about getting shots of the various participants like Eric Schmidt and Etienne Davignon and the usual crowd. So it's a very nice atmosphere and it's lovely weather. So, I mean, I'm having I'm having a good time.
If you're not allowed on the inside, of course, the weather makes quite a big difference. But what about, you were talking more about the military. It seems over the years, when Bilderberg started, they were inviting trade unionists, people like that. Now it seems to have gone more and more over to the military. We've got Sherrod Cowper-Coles from the board of BAE Systems. And last year, there certainly was a guy from EADS, these big military arms firms. You've got also the intelligence people. It seems to have steered much more over the years towards military people being in there. And of course, you know, it's reputed anyway that Bilderberg is where the Secretary of General of NATO is chosen.
Right, well, yes, it's, I mean, there's certainly a lot of arms interests here this year. There's Tom Senders, who's the head of Airbus now, which is here, and so two people from Saab, and so there's lots of that kind of, there's that sort of half of the war is here, and then there's a lot of the intelligence services here. So there's a head of MI6, and Keith Alexander, who's just been replaced as head of the NSA, he's here, and they're discussing intelligence sharing and stuff like that. So yeah, there's a lot of, you know, there's quite a few ex-CIA director type people and national security advisor types. I mean, I think there's two national security ex-national security advisors here. So because Kissinger was one, and I think Thomas Donnell, I don't know how you say it, is another. So anyway, lots of intelligence, military, arms, the usual cheery mix, and of course billionaire investors looking to make a buck out of it all.
Now, I mean, at the top of the hour, I was talking about the, you know, I have quite a big problem with all the politicians going in there and swearing to secrecy under the Chatham House rules, as well as the media. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, someone actually made a good point to me outside the case yesterday, where they said, well, if it's actually Chatham House rules, then they can just, you know, publish the, you know, the results of the conference, but in an unattributed way, you know, as long as you don't attribute quotes to names, and that's still, you know, in inverted commas, Chatham House rules. So it's not, you know, they call it Chatham House rules, but actually it's just extreme privacy. And yeah, absolutely, there's altogether too many politicians here for anyone who's a fan of democracy's taste. That's a terrible sentence, but you know what I mean.
Now, one of the things that they're saying they're talking about in there is, does privacy exist? This is thrown into really sharp relief because it was at the Bilderberg conference in Watford last year here in the UK, exactly a year ago, that we first heard the name Edward Snowden, and the man with his little pen drive has really shaken much of the Western world with the information he's held about what these intelligence services are up to, what the NSA are up to, what GCHQ are up to, and of course these guys are actually in there. So why are we discussing, or what do you think they might be saying about whether privacy exists? Because of course they don't seem to want it to exist.
Well, certainly people like insurance companies and you know, big oil companies don't want it to exist. By which I mean they want the general public to be as transparent as you could possibly be. And you know, it's being discussed by people like Eric Schmidt of Google and Reid Hoffman of LinkedIn and the big social media people like Peter Thiel from Facebook. These are people that know precisely how transparent the general public is to corporations and governments. So yeah, it's a very peculiar topic of conversation. It makes me feel a little uneasy, particularly when you know, there's a kind of two-tier privacy going on here. You know, I mean, I feel as nude to them as I could possibly be in terms of my general, you know, comings and goings in the world, but they are still extremely removed from the gaze of the media and the public.
Of course, one of the things that Snowden's revealed is that these technology companies that you mentioned there that are sitting in there are actually much, much closer than we thought to the intelligence gatherers, you know, the signals intelligence people, the NSA and GCHQ. I mean, it does seem that even Google has been trying to thwart attempts to pull them up on selling privacy and giving privacy information over to the NSA. So is it fair to say that actually what they're doing is, you know, wooing the big guys, are wooing Google and making sure that the media, as it moves into the future, is going to be a kind of front for the intelligence gathering services?
Yeah, I mean, you can see the sort of wall between these two things melting away. I mean, I've seen a photograph just now of Eric Schmidt talking to Alex Karp, who's the head of Palantir Technologies, which was set up using money from the CIA and from Peter Thiel. And so there's this kind of weird mix of intelligence and tech and software and surveillance and data analysis and all of this, and it's one big terrible mess in which the general public tends to drown.
Now, one of the things I can remember from going to these conferences, I went to one in 2000 and one in 2003, Charlie, was that it was great chit-chatting in the bar at the hotel of Big Jim Tucker. So has there been any kind of networking between people who are over there to report on it, and also Bilderberg watchers, Bilderberg followers who are sharing info with people like yourself?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, as I always say, it's the... obviously, apart from my conversations with you and other times of the year, this is the place I get to meet the most informed and intelligent people that I ever get to meet. You know, definitely, that's the case. You know, I've already had incredible conversations with people telling me stuff that I didn't know, and, you know, which is obviously...
Well, come on, let's have a few... Any thoughts about, you know, how, for you, this year has brought your knowledge on of how who these people are and who they operate, you know, behind that wall of secrecy?
Oh, I can't say anything like that. It would make me sound too insane. I tell you what it is, though. It's a good. There's a lot of sharing of. There's a lot of sharing of photographs. A lot of sharing of. You know, people identifying other people, talking about other people are clued up in different areas. So someone will be very into different. You know, there's people, there's reporters here from around the world. So someone will know a Spanish politician and their relationship to a Greek politician and all of that kind of thing. So there's a great resource of information here and knowledge. So
what about Ukraine? That's another thing that's on the agenda there. Any thoughts about what they may be discussing in there? Because you know, this seems to be the big business of the moment. What do you think that they will be discussing to do with Ukraine? And what's the point of
you know,
that?
I actually don't know, but I do. I mean, I do know that I wish they weren't discussing it with Henry Kravis and General Petraeus.
Why is that?
Yeah. You know, that's basically my the beginning and end of my problem with this is the presence of so many politicians and policymakers with so many hungry billionaire investors and corporate types, and I say corporate types, corporate heads, and you know that's for me the real problem here. I don't know about the specifics, but I do know that the mechanics of it is really properly flawed. It's a kind of disgrace to democracy, I think.
And also, what about any kind of organised counter-conference? Because I understand that George Butler, who does the Secret Truth programme over in Austin, Texas, is down there trying to organise some kind of counter-conference. Sounds like a great idea.
Well, I haven't met him yet, but I look forward to finding out about it. And if there is such a thing, I'd love to go along and listen.
Okay, finally, Charlie, one of the other things that's on the agenda for them is the future of democracy and the middle-class trap. Well, what about the future of democracy with these guys?
Well, I don't know. I don't think the future of democracy and this kind of organisation are compatible. If by the future of democracy you mean a future which has democracy in it, because this just isn't anything. And I just when people say, "Oh, don't worry," it's these people have got to get together to discuss this kind of thing. Otherwise, nothing gets done. I just find that which I've heard every so often, well, quite a lot, in fact. But that attitude is such an infantile attitude that I just despair. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't quite know what the future holds for Bilderberg. As people become more and more aware of how they're being screwed and how they're being ignored by the, you know.
I suppose, I mean, I said last question, but I mean, I suppose this Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership is a perfect example of a massively important policy which has not been debated by Parliament and has not really been discussed in the press. We're just being told this is what's going to happen. Just tell us a bit about that particular issue, because that's one of the things we know Bilderberg is pushing. They're trying to get this trade deal signed between the US and the EU.
That's the thing that perhaps annoys me the most on a specific level, is that because there are so many lobbyists here from organisations that have been pushing, and I mean really, really pushing and promoting this deal. A lot of trade organisations and lobby groups. And when I say members, I mean like the tops of these groups. And yeah, so you've got a kind of horrific mix of lobbyists, interested parties, negotiators, you know, like EU commissioners on behalf of Europe. They're here. Then you've got, you know, other sort of foreign ministers, and so you've got all of the regulators, the lobbyists, everyone involved in this deal, except the general public, who it will affect, is there. And it's pretty awful, and people should look up TTIP and see what it's about to do to us.
Okay, Charlie Skelton from The Guardian, thanks very much. And I think people, am I right in saying people can just follow your stuff by buying The Guardian the next couple of days?
Oh, yeah. I'm about to file off another piece now.
Okay, thanks, Charlie Skelton. Thanks very much for joining us from Copenhagen and the Bilderbergers Conference. Thanks very much.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice,
Martin,
for Bristol. Oh. This is BCFM 93.2.
Okay, Martin, just having a chat to Charlie there. Fascinating to hear. But what is your problem with the Bilderbergers? I know you've seen this as an organisation where the big business, the super elite, the richest rich people in the Western world go and look over, pick over the politicians to see which ones they like, which ones they don't like, which ones they're going to be backing. So give us your take on these guys.
Well, I think that's basically, as I say, I see it a bit like a gypsy horse fair, if you like, where the politicians are bought and sold by the big money guys. But of course, the other thing that's very clear is the military and the intelligence services are there. Now, the military and the intelligence services are supposed to be subservient to the politicians. So if you're going to have a political meeting, you'd have the politicians, the military and the intelligence services, but no private business. But having the why are the private business people there?
Well, it's a bit like going down to the Freemasons Hall here in Bristol. I remember, as I did once, to find that the chairman of the bench of magistrates was just a little lowly Freemason, and other Freemasons were ordering him around.
Yeah, well, what worries me is that a plan is being cooked up for a war around the Ukraine, and you hinted at that in your question to Charlie. The fighting in the Ukraine is intensifying in the East Ukraine. The selection on Sunday doesn't seem to have resolved the fighting.
Was it an election, a proper election? Because there were certain candidates excluded.
Well, yes, and certain candidates were excluded.
It's a bit like Egypt, I think, in Ukraine, you know, where you've got an election, but actually, for example, in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood were completely banned.
Well, that's the difference. There are some links. I mean, I was reading earlier today on RAA Novosti that the Russians are claiming that Syrian militants are fighting with the Ukrainian armed forces. And, of course, with the UNA, UNSO, who are part of the Ukrainian far right, they have definitely been fighting in Chechnya with the jihadi rebels there. And of course, all of these jihadi rebels and neo-Nazis are cooperating with NATO. I mean, Bilderberg is essentially a NATO structure. And NATO has been, basically is taking control of this situation.
So you do wonder, don't you, with the elected politicians in there in the press, who's in the driving seat?
Well, who's in the driving seat is the globalised financial and military elite. The politicians are very much the junior partners, but the politicians are invited to basically be schmoozed by the real power brokers. It's not as if the politicians call the meeting, as it were, and then they invite these other chaps to come along. It's the wealthy people who call the meeting, and they invite the military and the politicians to come along. And no doubt the military are more in tune with the multi-billionaires than they are with the politicians. And the politicians really are there as gophers.
Now, those politicians are, as MPs, are breaking the ministerial code. The only trouble
Indeed.
Is David Cameron is the guy who's in charge of policing the ministerial code.
Well, I mean, if you remember, George Osborne went to Bilderberg a couple of years ago and tried to claim it was a private meeting and therefore he didn't have to report on what had happened. And it turned out that he'd taken his Treasury team civil servants with him.
So this is paid for
by public money. Now, I would argue that the politicians and the military and intelligence services are supposedly our servants. And if they go to this meeting, I want a minute of that meeting. And if we're not getting a minute of that meeting, then that's not satisfactory
in any way, shape, or form. The implications for this of what's happening in Ukraine then? Because it does sound that there's kind of privatised military which is co-opting politicians onto its little game.
Well, as you'll know my views about what's been happening in the Ukraine, because we've been talking about them several weeks running on the show. I think NATO basically played a psychological war game in Ukraine. The protesters that were shot at the beginning of the takeover in February, evidence from telephone intercepts and elsewhere points definitely towards the current government shooting its own protesters. The telephone intercept between Catherine Ashton and Umas Pirts, the Estonian foreign minister. Again, it's been reported in the international press but hardly mentioned at all in the West. Now, I would have hoped that might have created a situation where even the West Ukrainian nationalist type people would have felt, well, hang on a minute, our own people are shooting us, that's not satisfactory. Poroshenko, who seems to have won this election in the West, and I'm prepared to accept that, that he's won the election. The Russian government have accepted that he's won that election. He hasn't got any votes in the East because Crimea, Luhansk and Donetsk didn't vote. So it's a bit like, you know, he's won the vote in the Irish Republic, but he hasn't won it in Northern Ireland. Now, the point is, he's actually relatively moderate. The Russians seem to be prepared to talk to him. But what's happening on the ground in East Ukraine, as far as I can see, is that the fighting is intensifying. And
well, it's been around the airport, hasn't it?
Well, not just around the airport, also around Slovyansk this afternoon. The elected mayor of Slovyansk is suggesting there's up to 600 dead and lots of civilians and so on. So this is definitely escalating out of control. And what the new president of Ukraine has got to do, in my view, is pull his troops back, stop the fighting, and start the talking. The idea that by force they can reincorporate Donetsk and Luhansk into Ukraine is absurd and ludicrous. It's very similar to what sort of thing we've seen in Bosnia, in Ireland, in Yugoslavia, etc. And everybody's just got to take a step back.
Now, there was a downed helicopter yesterday and the fighting going on around the airport. I mean, is there any way that you think that the new president is going to just say, well, you know, because he did say we want to stop the violence, but then he's sending the troops in?
Well, what he said is that they're prepared to negotiate about federalism, but that everybody's got to put their weapons down and stop fighting. That's not going to happen. You've got, basically, the Ukrainian army is not really a professional army. It's got Pravi Sector and other right-wing militants like the UDR morphing into the UDA in a Northern Irish metaphor, and you've also got Western mercenaries fighting and possibly jihadis from Syria, and all of this is being coordinated by NATO. And it's possible that Bilderberg is talking about how are we going to use this to make trouble for the Russians, because of course what the US wants is for the EU not to be able to do deals with the Russians, so that they've got to do free trade deal with the US. And Leap 2020, the French think tank, pointed out quite a long time ago that probably this is all to do, this coup and violence in the Ukraine and this estrangement with Russia, is about trying to force the EU into the American sphere of influence. And this is the sort of thing that Nigel Farage really ought to be going on about. Who really runs Britain? It's not Brussels, it's Washington. And who runs Washington? Well, Tel Aviv.
Well, I mean, Farage did talk about, didn't he? The UK Independence Party leader did talk about the EU provoking stuff in Ukraine.
Well, he did,
but
in actual fact, it's not. It's quite obvious from the telephone intercept with Catherine Ashton that she didn't really know what was going on. The real problem is NATO's Gladio structures, which have been operating in Western and Eastern Europe for many decades.
But what about this other telephone intercept with Victoria Nuland, where she actually admitted that $5 billion had been spent in Ukraine, in Kiev, in fomenting the popular uprising at the end of last year and beginning of this year?
Well, what that means is that they gave money to people like us to run radio stations, to diss the government, etc. So instead of doing it as volunteers like we do, people would be paid to do what we do.
So this is a
diss
kind
the government.
Of psyop, is it? Is that what
yes,
they would call
psychological
it?
Psychological warfare. Absolutely. That's exactly what's going on. And I'm worried that they haven't gone to all of this trouble to back off now. Because in actual fact, making an enemy state out of Russia is the goal. They know that they can't necessarily win. That's not the point. The point is that the West... Rory Stewart, head of the Commons Select Committee on the Defence, saying, oh, we're going to have to create new bases in Eastern Europe and spend more on armed forces. So, of course, all of these people, these weapons manufacturers, that's great. If we can have Russia as an enemy again, then we're going to need loads more weaponry to be bought, and it'll create jobs in Filton, etc., etc.
Well, worth pointing out, of course, that Rory Stewart has just taken over chairing the Defence Select Committee, which oversees defence spending. It's supposed to be a scrutiny committee. He's a Bilderberger too. He's
well,
very
indeed.
Friendly with this lot.
Indeed, and I think that the whole thing has been a NATO psychological warfare operation from the get-go. It's not entirely played out as they would have liked, but at the same time, having a conflict
is there any real possibility of conflict with Russia over this, though?
Well,
it's already happening. There's exercises.
People are dying as we speak, Tony. That is a conflict.
People are trying to not between NATO and Russia yet, but people are, as you say, people are dying. Do you think there's possibility of, because that's the sort of conflict that could turn nuclear, isn't
well,
it?
Well, it is, but the Russians are basically, the Russians have been taking, despite what idiots like Prince Charles have been saying, the Russians have in fact been taking quite a backseat role and trying to be mediators rather than provokers. But in the West, you've got people, including Ed Miliband, the Labour leader, who seems to have not got the plot, missed the point here. That people should, that there are obviously strong feelings on both sides in the Ukraine. Ukraine's only existed as a country since 1991. There's no reason why it should necessarily cohere together, and it's quite possible it could break up. But these things don't necessarily.
I mean, isn't it going to be a bit of Northern Ireland style situation where you've got one side? Well, yeah, one side saying, "Well, we want this bit separate for ourselves." How is this going to play out, do you think, over the next couple of months? Do you think the Kiev government's going to be successful in its attempt to take over
in
the East?
But what's going to happen is that fighting in the East is going to intensify. What seems to be happening is that the population in Luhansk and Donetsk is being radicalised by the brutality of the Ukrainian army's tactics. And that, in fact, does not mean that you're going to win. It means that you are now setting in for a long-running guerrilla war in that region.
Not another one. I mean, we've had Iraq, Afghanistan. These wars seem to go on for years.
The other thing that's happening next week is the vote in Syria. And I was reading earlier on the internet that Syrian exiles in Lebanon and other places are besieging the Syrian embassy in order to vote for Assad. And the Western media hasn't really been reporting it, but the Lebanese Star reported it earlier. Huge crowds of Syrian refugees mobbing the Syrian embassy in order to vote for Assad.
Okay,
that's not the sort of thing that the West wants. The Western media likes to talk about. But I mean, we've just had an election in Egypt, which Sisi has kind of won on 40%.
But by banning the opposition, last time.
Yes, well, he killed 1,000 people and 16,000 people in detention.
That's like the Labour Party somehow taking power in a coup and banning the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats.
Yes, but if more than 50% of people vote, then you can claim that you've got some kind of mandate. But they haven't reached 50%, even though they kept the polls open for 3 days. What may happen next week is that Assad will get over 50% of the people participating in his election and voting for him. So you'll have a better democratic mandate than Sisi, and a better democratic mandate than many Western politicians.
Well, Libya is another one, which is one of these Bilderberg-type wars where a lot of Bilderberg-type people involved in it. Look, the US has just dispatched 1,000 Marines to Libya's coast because fighting's escalating, Martin. What on earth is going on in Libya? This, again, has dropped off the headlines ever since it happened.
Libya's yesterday's news, isn't it? We don't even want to talk about that. But the fact is that the so-called elected government of Libya, which has got an Islamist influence in it, is being overthrown by this ex-general of Gaddafi's, who then worked for the CIA for many years, and it's turning into Iraq. That's what's happening in Libya. So it's another fine mess you've gotten us into.
Is it really a mess? Is this a mistake, or is it a deliberate attempt to turn these into failed states?
I think there is it's win-win for the global elite. They either get what they want in terms of a government which doesn't.
What did the Bilderbergs get out of this?
Well, the military supplying people, they get war is good for business. The Vietnam War was very good for business in the US, even though the US lost. So they're not that bothered about winning. But of course, what you do is Ukraine has now become a huge headache for Putin, who is your political opponent. Libya, instead of being run by somebody who's got an independent policy, is now a mess. But at least it hasn't got an independent policy. And we can't get the oil out of Libya or Iraq because it's such a mess. But neither can the Chinese, and that's what this is really about. You don't need to take over a place. What you need to do is prevent somebody else from getting their hands on those resources.
Sounds like a beggar thy neighbour foreign policy.
Indeed it is. And it makes you weep with despair to realise in the 100th anniversary of the First World War that the beggar my neighbour, you can't have it because we can't have it attitude is alive and well in the world we live in.
Okay,
but weaponry is a lot more dangerous than it was in 1914.
Okay, well, let's take a little zoom back into the Bilderberg conference and see some of the individuals who are in there. I mean, it's really interesting to see who's there each year. The list is produced. We know also that some people do turn up. I can remember in 1998 hearing from a woman who worked in the hotel where Bilderberg were meeting in Scotland that Tony Blair had popped in, even though he wasn't on the list, for breakfast, and spent a couple of days at the hotel, even though he wasn't on the list. But in the from the UK, we've got Marcus Agius. One of the things that there's a website called VidRebel, VidRebel at WordPress.com, and he this chap has done an annotated members list, because what the Bilderbergs do is they produce a list of people who are attending the conference, but then they have a very short explanation of who they are and often ignore the person's main job. For example, James Wolfenson, it says on the list, is head of Wolfenson and Company. Well, actually, he's also the former head of the World Bank, but they don't mention that. So it's quite interesting sometimes to go through these. One of the things that this blogger has pointed out is that there's a lot of people on the list who have very close relationship with Goldman Sachs and the Rothschild family.
Yes, and I think what's very interesting about this is that for many years Bilderberg denied that it existed or that any meetings took place. And I think in the last few years in particular, because of efforts by journalists like yourself and by Charlie Skelton, is that they can no longer deny that they exist or that the meeting takes place. I think quite possibly what happens at Bilderberg is decisions aren't made at Bilderberg. That's delusionary. The decisions are already made. They are being, they're basically being knocked out at Bilderberg. Well, and I understand that they come to agreements about what they are going to do and go away and do it.
Marcus Agius, for example, he's one of the British participants there. It says on the list he's the non-executive chairman of the PAE Consulting Group, whoever they are. But actually, what it doesn't tell you is his wife is Catherine de Rothschild. She was there with Prince Charles earlier this week in London talking about fairer capitalism, for example. Her father's Evelyn de Rothschild, his wife, who was co-founder of Bilderberg. So none of that's mentioned in the annotated list that we get from the Bilderbergers. And also, she used to be, Helen Alexander, chairman of UBM, they say, but she also used to be chief executive of the Rothschild-owned Economist Group. Lots and lots of these Rothschild people, also oil companies too. What about the oil interest in getting together with these power brokers, the Bilderbergers, Martin? Because we see lots of banks, we see royalty, but there's always the big oil companies there too.
Well, yes, we can. I mean, it's a who's who of the kleptocratic global elite, isn't it? I mean, in a way, by them all getting together in one spot every year, it makes it pretty obvious what's going on.
Well, you were
it?
Talking about petrodollars, for example, last week, weren't you? And what will they be looking for? Because this is, I mean, obviously, places like Iraq is a big oil grab. Other places are looking for natural resources for themselves. But how is it going for these big global oil companies? We hear about peak oil, that oil is running out. This actually seems like it might be a bonus, in fact, for the oil companies as they start to jack up the price.
Yeah, what they're determined to do is to keep the petrodollar system intact. I'm quite sure that will be a major Bilderberg aim. And the petrodollar system means that if you want to buy oil, you've got to have dollars to buy it in.
Now, what power do the Russians and the Chinese have to break that
system?
They've
just signed.
I know Colonel Gaddafi was trying to do
Colonel
it.
Colonel Gaddafi
he?
Was setting up something called the Libyan Gold Dinar, which was going to be based on gold, but would also mean that you could buy oil.
Well, he was also talking about the African Gold Dinar which would be something which would give Africa an
independent
currency.
Saddam Hussein
currency.
Started to price his oil in euros before the invasion of Iraq. This is the crucial thing. If the Russians and the Chinese and the other BRICS, as they called, will be looking to create a non-dollar-based oil buying system. What's very significant on this front is that Modi, who is the far-right Hindu nationalist who's just won the election in India, under a first-past-the-post system, so he's got a massive majority, even though he only got 30-something percent of the vote, but he is now the new leader of India. They inherited their system from us. And he invited... Interestingly enough, he invited Nawaz Sharif from Pakistan to come along to his inauguration, which is the first time that's ever happened, which is I think is potentially positive. And he's also going to talk to the Chinese, because of course India is the big swing state in all of this. If India decides to throw in its lot with China and Russia, then the writing is on the wall for the petrodollar system. And I think the writing's on the wall for the petrodollar system anyway, because the Federal Reserve's money printing is constantly undermining the dollar. people are only holding the dollar now because they have to buy oil. If they didn't have to buy oil, they'd love to get out of the dollar. So I think there's going to be a huge shock and a realignment of geopolitical forces. But of course, people who are living on in the shatter zone will pay the price. And of course, East Ukraine is that place at
well,
the moment.
Yes, but talking about the shatter zone, back in 2003, 4, 5, 6, and right up to today, that's Iraq. We've just heard this week that the crucial letters our elected politicians were exchanging, George W. Bush, Tony Blair, over the Iraq war, now will not be published, allegedly. This is the Chilcot inquiry, which has cost a fortune several years ago, lots and lots of inquiries, but it's still a lot going to be massively redacted. It seems that the people in power want us never to know what really happened.
Well, in that case, we can draw our own conclusions. They're lying. They were lying about Iraq. They lied about Libya. They're lying about the Ukraine. They lied about 9/11. They lie. And that's all people really need to know. They just lie. So whenever they open their mouths, they're lying. And that's quite straightforward, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but who is they? I mean, is there any sort of chinks of light at the end of the
well,
tunnel
they,
in our politics?
Well, they are the people at Bilderberg. And I include in that the Labour front benchers who've deigned to... what I would like to hear from Peter Mandelson and from Ed Balls what was discussed. Ed Balls aspires to be Chancellor of the Exchequer of this country. I want to know what he's agreed with Google, what he's been talking to with the IMF. And I'm afraid that's the way it works.
What about that? What we were discussing with Charlie there, the security connotations of Google, Facebook, Microsoft, LinkedIn, these other organisations now on the internet, the social media, etc., that we give fantastic amounts of our own personal information to these systems. I mean, for example, I sent an article off to a Gmail address. It was very, very critical of Google. It was explaining the way that they were trying to stop their customers actually getting their rights. And that article just disappeared. It never got where it was supposed to go. Someone on Google, I would imagine, or at the NSA, who were cooperating with Google, just deleted it.
Well, yes. I mean, that's the reality of the situation we live in. But the Taliban are still thrashing all these marvellous generals like Petraeus, who's the new Napoleon. He's being thrashed by the Taliban because in many parts of Afghanistan, they've got no electricity, therefore no mobile phones, therefore no computers. They just rely on good old-fashioned tradecraft. And that's the future of 21st century warfare as well.
I mean,
these people think that they control the situation.
Getting back to Chilcot,
when it comes to a real fight against real opponents, they can't do anything.
Getting back to Chilcot, though, I mean, the problem with this is it sends out a very clear signal to our current political leadership that if you want to keep things secret, you get up to no good and skullduggery of one sort or another, war crimes even, that we're going to keep it all secret.
Yes, but the point is, the other thing is that the records of everything they've done are there. And ultimately, that means we can access them.
So how come people like Blair and Kissinger, quite obviously, there is prima facie evidence for war crimes by these people, how come they're still walking the streets?
Because there's no will to enforce the law against big criminals.
I mean, isn't that really what Bilderberg is?
Their name isn't Gaddafi, it's Bush and Blair.
Isn't this one thing Bilderberg tells us, so that actually the rule of law, there is a glass ceiling for it. There's no way that this is going to reach certain people. There is an elite that simply are above, they're like Judge Dredd, above the law.
They are, but they shouldn't be. And I think the demand has got to be quite clear that we want and will enforce the law. That's what we fought two world wars for. We're not going to give up that demand.
Is there any hope of that, really, though?
I think there is. I think those who are pushing for further war are idiots who will bite off more than they can chew. They haven't won
anything.
They've
been very successful so far in terms of money. They've devastated entire countries, and they're still devastating countries, but they're making a lot of money at it.
They are, and the criminal ruling class, in fact, has made more money since the onset of the crisis than they made before the crisis. So there is no crisis from their point of view, which is why they're now having a sort of a kind of panicky moment where they talk amongst themselves about how they're going to carry on getting away with it. But they have to talk amongst themselves about that, because ultimately they know this is unsustainable. They do know.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, the chairman of the Bilderbergs for the first 20 years was Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, a former SS officer, a member of the Nazi Party, who actually lied about his Nazi Party membership too, whilst he was still alive. And so to have a look at the whole origins of the Bilderberg, I thought we'd go to have a listen to an American academic and author. His name is Stephen Kinzer, and he's the author of a book called The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and Their Secret World War. Now, Martin, before we hear from Stephen Kinzer, can you just tell us a little bit about the... they were very big in the 1950s, but they'd also been fraternising with the Nazis before the war and through the war. Who were the Brothers?
Well, they were through the law firm Sullivan and Cromwell. Prescott Bush, who was the grandfather of George W. Bush, was a major funder and financial supporter of the Nazis. I mean, they looked after their financial affairs on Wall Street. And these people then helped to set up the... they were in the OSS during the war, which is the US Secret Service. They helped to set all that up. And they helped to set up the CIA. And the CIA and NATO, as they were being set up in the 1940s, were integrating the former Nazi intelligence apparatus, so that the head of the West German intelligence services became Reinhard Gehlen, who was the head of the Gestapo in Eastern Europe. So these people have got form. Bilderberg is a piece of that jigsaw.
Now, so let's hear from Stephen Kinzer. He's the author of The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and Their Secret World War.
It's remarkable how all during the first half of the 20th century and right up maybe through the 60s, the making of American foreign policy was the province of a very small group of people. They were all white Protestant males who had gone to the same schools. They went to the same summer camps. They sailed in the same yacht clubs. They took vacations in the same place. They went to work for the same law firms. They dated the same girls. They went to the same investment banks. So you had a very inbred foreign policy, which was dedicated principally to defending American corporate power, because the people who were in that little elite all came from the corporate world. They were gathered in an organization that the Dulles brothers helped found, and that was the Council on Foreign Relations. I talk about that a little in this book, The Brothers, and one of the things that I noticed that I guess I hadn't realized before is that the Council on Foreign Relations has a motto. And it's actually, you can see it on the cover of their magazine, Foreign Affairs, but it's not very clear. You see this little logo, and it's got a flying horse, a Pegasus figure, and then there's a word around the top. It looks like just chicken scratch, but when you look at it more closely, it's a Latin word, and the word is ubique. It means everywhere. And that is a classic answer to the question, where does the United States have to intervene? Where does the United States have vital interests? Where do we have to be sure that we only have friends in office? Where must we project power? Everywhere. That's the motto of that corporate-based group that the Dulles brothers represented so perfectly.
Or you could say it in German, Über alles.
Yeah, that's George Butler who is interviewing him there. Martin.
Well, I mean, the history of Bilderberg is tremendously important. What's it Bob Marley said? Know your history, know your destiny. In the abundance of water, the fool is thirsty. This stuff has been going on for years. The corporate elite in the West worked very closely with the Nazis before the war. They integrated certain Nazis after the war, and they have a world domination agenda. Well, the Russian General Staff and the Chinese General Staff will know exactly what I'm speaking of.
Well, I know before the Second World War, actually, Prescott Bush, who you were talking about there, was working actually to have a coup in the United States, wasn't he, to actually take over
Indeed,
the Democratic
there was an
government.
Attempt to overthrow Roosevelt, which was thwarted by Smedley Butler, who was the most decorated US officer of all time, and he was approached by the coup plotters, including Prescott Bush, to take over, to be the front for the coup. As it happened, he just found out everything that was going on and went and told Roosevelt. The coup was crushed, but the history was suppressed. But the fact of the matter is that these families are crime families. The Bush family is definitely a crime family with Nazi connections. It always has been.
Let's hear a bit more from Stephen Kinzer, the author then of The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and Their Secret World War. This time he talks about the myth-making of America using Hollywood.
I'll tell you a little story. I teach at Brown University, and I teach a course called The History of American Intervention. And I have a little extra credit assignment. And the extra credit assignment is, go watch the movie Shane, which is a classic old Western, and tell me how it relates to American foreign policy. And the students are often quite puzzled because this is just a Western movie.
Right.
But actually, we talk about it and think about it, And you can see, and this is a point that I make in the book, that the concept that underlies Western movies really penetrated into the American psyche. That concept is fairly simple to define. Most classic Western movies, like Shane and like High Noon, are about a single theme, and that is you have an isolated town or a valley or a region where decent people cannot live because thugs beat them up and oppress them. Then one good man with a gun shows up. Nobody has invited him, but he knows instinctively what's right. So he goes in, he kills a few people, and just by killing a few people, all the trouble disappears. Good people can live freely again, and then he rides out of town into the sunset expecting no other thanks except for the knowledge that he helped pull people out of tyranny and give them a good life. This is the myth that propelled America to intervene in so many countries abroad. If you transfer that valley or that little town into, say, Iraq or Afghanistan, that becomes the place where decent people can't live freely because there's some tyrant. And the one good man with a gun who knows what to do, even though nobody's invited him, is the United States. We're going to go over there, and it's going to be pretty easy to fix it because we're just going to identify the few bad people, we're going to kill them, and then that'll make everything good again. This is a childish fantasy, which is great if you're a movie maker creating little cinema icons that last 2 hours, but right. Don't take this as something real that works.
Yeah, well, there's different levels on which this operates. There's the propaganda level, where the Americans see themselves as the world's policemen, as it were. And then there's the real level, where, in fact, they are the world's gangsters, pretending to be the world's policemen. And it's not even that they're deluded. They're not just deluded. They consciously, the people in charge know what they're doing, but they consciously lie about it.
John Foster Dulles was a great friend of the Nazi regime in its early years. In fact, as the Nazis choked down on the German people and the pogroms against the Jews began, some of the people in Sullivan and Cromwell, the law firm, decided, you know, it's time for us to close our office in Germany. We can't be working there and collaborating with Hitler. But John Foster Dulles, who was the senior partner at Sullivan and Cromwell, was very much against this. He actually had a very warm spot for the Nazis. And the reason was, the Nazis fit his definition of what is a free country, open to American corporate influence. As a matter of fact, Alan Dulles had a meeting with Hitler, and at one point he brought up the fact that it seems like squads of your goons are beating up Jews and killing them on the street. And Hitler replied, "We are only doing what is necessary to protect the millions of dollars in American money that is invested here in Germany." What a great answer, because that's all Alan Dulles needed to hear. So the Dulles brothers actually thought that Hitler was a positive force because he was so anti-communist, and particularly Foster Dulles, the older brother, continued visiting Germany right through the late 1930s and was writing articles at one point saying, "Only hysteria entertains the idea that Germany or Japan would contemplate a war against the United States."
Gosh. I mean, there's a lot more to this than the average person has ever been able to appreciate.
Well, that's what I'm devoting myself to in my writing. I think maybe the number one comment that I get from people who read my book, and I have gotten this in different forms literally hundreds of times over the years, is something like this. "I thought I knew about American history, but I never knew any of this." Or, "I read a lot of books. I went to school. I was taught American history. I knew about the world, but nobody ever mentioned any of this to me." So what I'm trying to do is rearrange history a little bit. The events of history don't change, but we can decide what's important and what's not important. There's a mainstream history that tries to tell you the main things that happen, and then there's a lot of other insignificant things. But my role is to look and say, you know, maybe it's the other way around. Maybe some of those things that the powerful want us to think were insignificant were actually the really big things that shaped our world. For example, the idea that the United States overthrew democracy in Iran in 1953 is thought of as some kind of a minor footnote to history, that it was just a tiny little one-month operation. If you look at what has happened to Iran for the last 60 years and look at the huge confrontation with the United States, between the United States and Iran, you realize that was not a little thing. And in my book, this latest book, The Brothers, and in some of my earlier books, I'm trying to bring into higher relief some pieces of American history that Americans are urged not to focus on, because otherwise they'll start thinking in dangerous ways.
Well, that's absolutely right, isn't it? History always counts in the end. What the NATO intelligence services, through their Gladio networks, for example, were involved in all kinds of terrorism in Italy, Belgium, Germany in the 1970s and 1980s. We now know this for a fact. Anybody listening to this show can check by just putting Gladio into a search engine. There's no dispute about it. So when they shoot people in the Maidan Square in Kiev, it fits a pattern that we know what NATO does. NATO does these kind of things. And of course, they've been doing it for so long now that they can't get away with just saying we don't do things like that, because we know they do.
Well, the interesting thing about, I think, about this book and the Dulles brothers is the way that he's shown there, the way that they were collaborating and very friendly with the Nazis in the run-up and actually to a certain extent during the war. And yet these two brothers, John Foster Dulles, who was Secretary of State, and his brother Alan Dulles, who was the director of the CIA, were both in charge, really, of US foreign policy in the 10 years after the war.
They did, and they recruited people like Reinhard Gehlen and possibly Martin Bormann, who were former Nazis, into their intelligence structure. There's no doubt about it. Reinhard Gehlen, who became head of the West German intelligence service, set up by the British and the Americans, was the former head of the Gestapo in Eastern Europe. He's the same guy. There's no doubt about it. That's history.
Well, that is history, but what about today? What about US foreign policy today? Let's go back to Stephen Kinzer.
So what I suggested in my book, Reset, which is the last book I wrote before this one, The Brothers, was this, essentially. We've had the same two allies in the Middle East for the last, well, let's say ever since World War II. And those are Israel and Saudi Arabia. But I argue that actually those are not the best long-term permanent allies for us, because their long-term security interests are not congruent with ours. What's good for Saudi Arabia is not good for us. What's good for us is not good for Saudi Arabia. We're spending billions of dollars buying oil in Saudi Arabia. The Saudis are using that to build these radical religious schools all over Asia and beyond, in which whole generations of little boys are taught how to chant the Quran and hate America. We are paying for that. So Saudi Arabia's interests are not our interests. However, take a look at two other countries in the region, Turkey and Iran. The only two, well, the two major non-Arab countries in the Muslim Middle East. Iran in particular is very intriguing, because although we have developed this idea that this is the evil, hostile focus of terror in the world, the fact is Iran's long-term strategic interests are very much in common with ours. Specifically, number one, Iran borders on Afghanistan. In fact, the entire western third of Afghanistan used to be part of Iran until Iran lost a war in the 19th century. So they speak the same language. Iran has a great ability to help stabilize Afghanistan, and they're very eager to do it because nobody wants turmoil on their border. On Iran's other border is Iraq. Also, Iran can have a great influence in calming Iraq, which is just what we want. Now, Iran isn't going to do that as long as they think the United States might use a stable Afghanistan and a stable Iraq to attack them. But if we can get on the same page, Iran can help us calm Afghanistan, calm Iraq. It can help us resolve the problem in Syria. It can help us control the Afghan drug trade, which is devastating Iran. And most of all, Iran is the bitter enemy of radical Sunni movements like the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. They were against the Taliban when we were still in bed with the Taliban and trying to make oil deals with them. So in the long run, Iran actually has strategic interests that are closer to ours than Saudi Arabia. Let's think about that when we're planning our long-term future in the Middle East.
Well, I think that's what I would call a limited hangout. The elite that we're talking about, the Bilderberg NATO elite, they don't want to settle relations with Iran and Russia and China. They want war. They want conflict. It's not in the interest of ordinary people, but these people, the Dulles brothers, and all of the and
but
the,
you can see where he's coming from, surely. Where he's saying is, from a logical foreign policy, clear, clean point of view, academic point of view, in a way, that actually there's no good funding Saudi Arabia and doing deals with Saudi Arabia because they are training loads of these radical Muslim terrorists as from being young
kids. But that's what we wanted them to do in the 1980s, and we were happy for them to do it. Al-Qaeda was set up by MI6 under Operation Cyclone, and in actual fact, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, which overthrew Gaddafi, has been working with MI6 for 40 or 50 years. The idea that we're opposed to radical Islam is a nonsense. What we do is we use radical Islam. Many of these radical groups and individuals are in fact agents of Western intelligence services, and it's all part of psychological warfare operations as practiced by the Nazis and by the CIA since World War II.
And another story which has come out, which is really shocking, about the American intelligence services: the CIA have been barred from using vaccinations as cover after dozens of doctors were killed. The White House has announced the CIA will never again set up a fake vaccination program as part of its espionage efforts following the lethal response to the strategy employed before raiding Osama bin Laden's compound in 2011. Promise was made in a letter to the deaths of 12 public health schools who have criticised the Obama administration for using vaccination effort as a cover for a reconnaissance, and was written to the president's top counterterrorism Homeland Security. So these people were getting a programme of vaccinations out in Afghanistan, but it turns out actually it was a CIA intelligence gathering.
Yeah, but the real story there, of course, is, as Seymour Hersh has pointed out, the most senior investigative journalist in the US, Osama bin Laden was not in that compound and he wasn't killed. It's all a lie, like all the other lies.
Also, Washington is spending £200 million creating an intelligence hub in Britain. This is Washington spending £200 million. It's already implicated in mass surveillance and drone strikes, but it's actually expanding here in Britain.
Well, I mean, the point is the lineaments of a totalitarian fascist state are staring us in the face. It's the 100th anniversary of World War I. It's time that the people of the world stood up and put a stop to this nonsense.
OK, time to sign off now. Time for the Murdoch News at 7 o'clock. We're online at thisweek.org.uk. Have a good weekend and don't let the banksters get you down.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on...